Mr. Dan.
Talking about my generation.
Good Sunday morning and welcome to My Generation on 106.9 WCTR. I'm your host, Larry Vedder, and I have a special guest today. For those of you who are regular listeners to the show, you know that every once in a while I put on my nerd hat, and I get very excited when I get somebody from NASA talking. You all know that I enjoy astronomy and space travel. So my guest today is a NASA employee. His name is Warren Case, and he's worked for NASA for long time, from what I understand. But he's also an instructor, a part-time instructor at WC All, and he taught a course on space travel, and that's how I met him. So anyway, good morning, Warren. How are you?
Good, good. If I might clarify one thing, I actually work for a company at NASA.
Okay.
When I first started NASA, I was going to college, and I was working there as a federal, under a federal program. And I would work there during the summers, during the winter break, and so forth. And after a few years, I ended up switching to contract, and I've been contract ever since.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. How many years have you been involved with them?
It's a lot of years. Before the turn of the century.
Oh, well,
but no, I mean, it's been
over... that long ago.
it's been over 40 years. Oh, so I started there in the planetarium that we had at Goddard Space Flight Center, Greenbelt, Maryland. Okay. And then went to the visitor center. And then after a year or so there, I ended up going down to one of the buildings to do real work, meaning to actually process satellite data and so forth. And it's progressed from there through shuttle and through other things.
Okay.
And more recently, 4 years ago, at headquarters, downtown D.C.
All right, so everybody understands, NASA has a lot of different things, from space travel to manned vehicles, unmanned vehicles, to propulsion, and on and on and on. Roughly, what area do you work in?
I'm actually working in Earth science. We have a number of Earth science satellites that are looking down on the Earth and making a lot of different measurements. This really goes back, I mean, you could say the Landsats back in 1972 were doing a lot of that, and it's just been progressing from that time ever since.
All right.
And so my job at headquarters involved with trying to monitor those missions, a couple dozen missions.
Okay. However, you are, because you're working there and you worked there for so long, you're pretty familiar with more than just that particular area.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, my own personal interest is more in the astronomy end.
Okay.
And then work with manned flight, with shuttle and space lab.
All right. So I know that you've been teaching, you just started teaching a course at WC All. It's the adult courses at Washington College. And you taught a course on space travel. And I believe you're fairly new to the area, correct?
That's correct. My wife and I just moved here in April. And living up towards Wharton, and just love the area. It's great.
All right, so you'll be here about a year this year.
It's getting close. It's amazing how time flies.
Okay. All right, so how did you get involved in teaching this class?
Oh, let's see. Well, of course, you know, it goes back to my own interest in astronomy and in space travel. When I got over to Kent County, and we were talking about it'd be nice to get involved in the community and get to know people. And we learned about WC All and so forth. That seemed like a great opportunity to give the course there for something familiar with and get to know a number of people here. And that's worked out very well, including yourself, meeting yourself there.
Yeah, I did the same thing myself when I first came here. I immediately dove right into something at WC All. I happened to see them with a booth at the farmer's market one day. And at that time, they were looking for instructors with new classes. And I thought, well, I had worked in an industry for a number of years. I thought, I'll see if I can teach a class like that. And I've been doing it ever since I've been here. And I enjoy it. And you're right. It's a great way to meet people. It's a great way to learn things yourself, too. You along the way, I found that I was teaching a class on environmental sciences. I met a lot of people who were very heavily involved in it and probably taught me a few things as well, too. So it was interesting to do that.
Yeah, I could easily give a plug for WCO. I think it's a great program. And plus, anytime you teach something, you tend to research it and you learn more about it yourself. I learned a lot more about the history of space exploration, manned space exploration, more than I knew just because of getting ready for the class.
All right. So let's jump into the topic of the day, the space travel. So I wanted to talk a little bit about manned space travel and unmanned space travel as well, too, because obviously unmanned is a little bit cheaper and a little bit easier to do. Not that anything is easy to do when it comes to space travel.
Sure.
But it is a little bit easier because you're not trying to keep somebody alive in an unmanned space travel, which is adds a whole nother set of problems to it. How far back does your interest go? Because I don't remember as a kid. I remember Alan Shepard and I remember Sputnik even before that, and even the first monkey. I can't think of the monkey's name right now. That oh no, it was a dog, Laika, right?
Well, that was the Russian.
That
dog.
Was the Russian.
That
dog.
Was the first living mammal to go up in space was a dog.
Right, the dog
from
Laika.
Russia.
Yeah,
we sent chimps up.
Right.
Which I'm trying to remember the name of the chimp now. Ham.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the initial ones, and then of course. The excitement when Alan Shepard went up, and I think back very often about that basically he shot up and came right back down again.
Yep.
It was less than what SpaceX does today to send people up and back down again for a little mini trip to outer space.
Sure. It's actually in commercial space flight, which, you know, I don't know if we'll talk about it or not, but you have the two different types. You have the kind that go all the way into orbit, like the space station, and that would be like SpaceX rockets and so forth. And then you have the Blue Origin stuff right now that it just goes up and right back. And so Alan Shepard's flight was very similar to the Blue Origin flight in that Alan Shepard lasted about 15 minutes total from the time he launched from Florida, Kennedy Space Center, and landed in the Atlantic about 15 minutes later. Unlike, once you go into orbit, you can be up there for days, weeks, months, whatever.
Right, yeah, once you're up there. But that initial jolt to get into space. And I what I find interesting is I've seen the Mercury capsules at the museums in Washington, D.C., and I'm continuously amazed at this basic little can that they actually put a human being into that went into space. I don't know if I would be so willing to do that.
Yeah, as I've gotten older, I've gotten a little claustrophobic. I'm not so sure. What a lot of people don't know is when the first astronauts were picked, obviously they were picked because they were test pilots. They knew how to fly it. They knew how to operate under stress. But another key part of the criteria was they were no taller than, I think, 5'8" or something like that, or 5'9". Whatever, they had a height restriction for the first astronauts. If you ever see the original seven or so forth, they're not very tall people. And the reason was, logistically, to fit them inside this small tin can, and they just couldn't be very large, very tall.
Right. Now, they had no movement at all, right?
What's that?
They had no movement inside this capsule at all, did they?
Oh, no, they did. But it's just, remember you had three types. You had Mercury, which is a one-man spacecraft, followed by Gemini, followed by Apollo. And with each upgrade, you know, you had extra space added. When you had two people, you had to have extra space around, particularly because then they weren't with Mercury, you're only up there maybe 24 hours. I mean, John Glenn's flight, he was up there three orbits, so about 5 hours. But by the end of Mercury, they were staying up there almost 24 hours. When Gemini came along, they had to demonstrate a lot more capabilities, docking, other things. And they were up there up to 14 days. And 14 days in a tin can, you need a little bit extra space. Yeah. And then, of course, the moon missions, you had three astronauts inside this larger capsule. And those missions were comparable length, something like that, a little bit less than the 14 days.
It was an interesting time because everything was geared to the space race. It was the sort of that unwritten race that you had. Well, I guess it wasn't so unwritten. I guess it was pretty overt at the time.
It was, yeah.
Who was going to get out there first, the United States or the Soviet Union at that time? And for a long period, the Soviet Union was besting the United States on just about every aspect of it. And then all of a sudden, there was some sort of a catch-up and turnaround.
You know, that is true. At that time, the Soviet Union had larger boosters. Even us, we used converted ICBMs, really, for our first rockets, as did the Russians. And they just had larger boosters. They had built larger craft. The U.S., on the other hand, the boosters weren't as large. The rockets were not as large. So we were big into micro-miniaturization. It really kick-started the electronics industry in a lot of ways. But initially, they did have that head start. They had the first animal in space. They had the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin.
All right, and he immediately went into orbit, right?
Correct. They did not do a suborbital. They went straight to orbit. He went into one orbit and came back. They had that. They had the first spacewalk. They had the first multi-person craft ever sent to space. they had the first woman in space. It took us years later, which is unconscionable to think about it now, but Sally Ride wasn't until Space Shuttle in the 1980s. But they flew Valentina, I forget her last name, but
that was
in the
60s. Early on, too, right?
Yeah, it was one of the earlier flights. But what happened is that there were a series of setbacks on the Russian side, and at the same time, there were advances on the American side, and we as a country ended up passing by the capabilities they had. There's one pivotal moment in particular. The Russians were trying to build this large, enormous rocket, the moon rocket called the N1. And it had gobs, that's a technical term, gobs of rocket engines on it. And at the same time, the Americans were building the Saturn V rocket under Wernher von Braun and the Huntsville crew and so forth, five engines. The Russians attempted to launch the N1 rocket, I think, three or four times. Every single time it failed, usually very explosively. It was hard to get all the engines to work in sync back with the technology those days. And that was really their Achilles heel, why they did not perhaps beat us to the moon, was the failure of that rocket.
Failure of the booster.
If you had to pick one thing, that was probably it.
Yeah. Now, the original Mercury that went up there, that had virtually no technology whatsoever.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. No, it actually had a lot of current technology of the day. But, you know, by today's comparison, even Apollo, you know, people make the point that when Neil Armstrong landed Apollo 11 on the moon in 1969, the amount of computing power in the lunar lander he was flying was certainly less than your cell phone today.
Right.
And probably less than your smartphone. But it was very optimized code and software code, and it did its job.
Apparently, yeah. I mean, it was primitive, but it did definitely do its job. All right, we're going to take a short break right now. You're listening to My Generation on 106.9 WCTR. We'll be right back. Welcome back to My Generation on 106.9 WCTR. I'm your host, Larry Vedder. My guest this morning is Warren Case, who works for a contractor at NASA. And Warren, we've talked a little bit about your background so the members of the audience can get an understanding of what it is that you do. And then we went right into the topic of the day, which is space travel. So we just talked about a little bit about the early days of space travel before the break, but now I'd like to try to get into the propulsion, basically a couple of the main stages that are used to get these payloads up into space itself. And I wanted to talk about the fuel that's used in the propulsion, how we get up there, and talk a little bit about the speed that we need to get at and how it's impacted by the weight of the payload that we have in there. So why don't we start with, let's start with the speed. What is the speed that this unit needs to go to get into space, to break the gravitational pull?
Right. Now, clarification, you're not breaking the gravitational pull, but you're just trying to get up, balancing the gravity with your speed once you get into space. To stay in orbit, to get in orbit and stay there, you have to be going at least 17,000 miles an hour, 17,500 miles an hour, which is about 5 miles every second. That's the speed. The way space travel works, you have a rocket that goes up and you're way above the Earth. If you're doing like a Blue Origins where you go up and come back down, you get up into space and you're going 0 miles an hour. You just went to the top and you come right back down. To stay in space, you have to then turn 90 degrees and be flying horizontally. And you have to go fast enough so as you're falling, really the way an orbit works, you're going forward and you're falling because gravity's pulling you down. But if you go fast enough, as you fall down, the Earth is falling away from you, so to speak, the curve of the Earth. And so as you're going around, the curve of the Earth is moving down away from you, but you're going forward, and you keep going fast enough, you never hit the Earth because you keep falling around the Earth, which is why you're weightless also. So that speed, it turns out, for the mass of the Earth, and you have to get above the atmosphere, so you got to go at least 100 miles up, hopefully 200, so you don't have air drag. But that's about 17,500 miles an hour. The further out you go from the Earth, if you're up 400 miles, if you're up 600 miles, 1,000 miles, if you're out 22,000 miles, for example, you only have to go about 3,000 miles an hour to stay in orbit. But to have gotten out there, you needed a rocket that sent you there at faster than 17,000 miles an hour. Okay. It's just that the speed to stay in orbit gets less the further out you go.
Further on. All right, so when we're looking at, say at nighttime, we're looking at the space station, watching it travel mm-hmm. above us, which is pretty common in this area. It's pretty regular that you see it. That's moving at 17,500 on a steady basis?
Just a little bit less. It's a few hundred miles up, so it goes down slightly, but about 17,000 miles an hour. That's correct.
And if it would lose some of that speed, it would immediately come back down to Earth.
Well, it happens all the time. It's actually losing speed all the time. You got to realize that you can't fly a spacecraft 10 miles above the Earth because the air it will just hit you. It'll slow you down immediately. So you have to get above the air. Well, you never... totally above the air, despite what you think, when you get into space, say at 400 miles up, there's still a little tiny bit of air. And what happens as space stations going through that, and you hit a molecule of oxygen, you'll hit a molecule, whatever, and you just have this incremental slowing down, so that perhaps once a month, you have to raise the orbit up again, because every time you're slowed down, you lose energy and you start coming down slightly. And so I'm more familiar with some of the unmanned craft where basically you might come down a kilometer, half a mile, something like that. Mm-hmm. And after a month, you have to make up for that and raise it back up a half a mile.
And how is that done?
You just have rockets on board, thrusters on board. So miniature versions of the rockets that got you into space, you have these smaller rocket nozzles and you orient your spacecraft, whether it's unmanned spacecraft or space station, in the right direction the way you want to fire, and you fire those engines, and they expel, it's rocket fuel there is typically hydrazine, but it varies from spacecraft to spacecraft, and it gives you a little boost, and that little boost raises your orbit, and you're good for another month.
So would that be for any satellites that are up there?
Some satellites do not carry propulsion systems. It's a design issue. That takes up space, mass, expense and so forth. So some satellites are actually launched without propulsion. So once they're up there, you know eventually they're coming back because mm-hmm. they have no ways to counteract that occasional atmosphere you encounter. And that's part of the design. And they're designed to be up there no longer than a year, 2 years, whatever. If you have a larger spacecraft, it's intended to stay up there. Yes, it has a fuel tank. It has, usually it's a monofuel like hydrazine. Or it could be a fuel and an oxidizer, and that will maintain its orbit. We've had a spacecraft I work on for years called Terra. It was launched in December of 1999. It is still flying and still returning data. It's finally reached the point where it's getting near the end of its fuel resources, so it's slowly coming back in.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is that how sooner or later they're going to run out of fuel, so there's no way of refueling it.
Not yet. There are companies that are, and NASA, are working on ways to refuel spacecraft for that very reason, particularly for high cost assets.
Yeah.
This is more on the commercial side now. If you have a communication satellite that's placed out in geostationary orbit, 22,000 miles out, it's massive. And if all of a sudden it just failed because it had a problem with the fuel got lost somehow, like just happened with this other moon mission, companies are looking at ways to send up something which a little fuel tank that would refill the fuel tank of that satellite so it could extend it by years. But right now, currently, there's not, other than some experimental tries and development test environments and so forth that have gone up, there's not a operational capability yet, but it's not far in the future.
So that's interesting. So I know that there are hundreds of items floating around in space right now.
Yes.
All over the place, doing whatever, various things. So ultimately, if these things are not maintained by people, ultimately they're all going to come down.
Yes, that's true. The bigger worry is when they don't come down, if they hit each other. And that's, space debris is an ongoing problem. And it's getting to be more and more of a problem. And there are processes in place in the United States and in other countries that try to mitigate the increase in space debris. They will come down, but the further out you go, it's going to take a lot longer. So if some of these craft I was just talking about, if we did nothing, it would be about a century before they came down.
Okay.
The ones that are closer to the ground, it might be, you know, a few months. It really varies a lot. The further out you go, it increases dramatically. So if you're up 1,000 miles, it'll be several lifetimes, many lifetimes before they would come back. So there's an agreement, a guideline that NASA and other agencies have signed up to that's been in place at least since around 2000, where spacecraft are designed to re-enter within 25 years. 25 years seems like a lot, but when you compare it to maybe 500, 600, 700 years, if you did nothing, 500 years is not so bad. And so we subscribe to that, and so all of our missions and most other agencies' missions are designed so that you can lower the orbit towards the end of its lifetime to get it to a point where it will re-enter within 25 years. Mm-hmm. And there is talk of tightening that up. I've heard 5 years, for example. And so in the long run, then that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think back often to the Mir space mission that was back before the turn of the century.
Right.
And I remember when that it was essentially abandoned. And I remember when that was coming down, and there was a big question mark at that point where it was going to come down and if pieces would be large enough that could actually impact on the Earth. And I know that was a concern for a while.
Yeah, it was. I mean, well, even us, our Skylab, this first space station that the United States had, it came down uncontrolled. It's really affected. It was predicted to be up long enough for the space shuttle to have docked with it and raised it to a higher orbit. What happens is that the Earth goes through this cycle, 11-year cycle, solar max to solar min. We're actually approaching solar max. It'll probably happen next year in this 11-year cycle, which if you want to see the northern lights, that's a good thing.
That's the time to see it.
Yeah, so, you know, in the next year, 2 years is a good time. Hopefully we'll see northern lights. But what that does, it's like putting, if you have a balloon and you heat up that balloon, there's regular air inside the balloon, it expands. You know, the heat expands. Well, the same thing happens during solar max. As the sun is sending more energy towards the Earth, it heats up the atmosphere, and the atmosphere expands. Yes. And where some of our craft, we might have to do a, call it drag makeup maneuver. We have to raise the orbit. Maybe it'd be once every 3 months. During solar max, it might be once every month because the atmosphere comes up, and that quickly wreaks havoc with just bringing things down faster.
You just said something interesting a minute ago. You said that if the space shuttle would be able to put it in a further orbit. Mm-hmm. So the space shuttles, once they were in orbit, they actually had the ability to change their orbit?
Oh, they did all the time. Yeah. I mean, the most obvious one is they had retro rockets to change it so they could come back.
Right.
And that was a primary use of the OMS, orbiting maneuvering system. But no, they would change their orbit based on the requirement of, at the time. Space station changes their orbit primarily for debris purposes, but and also to counteract drag. But yes, without getting into the details of space shuttle, but space shuttle had three big engines at the tail of the orbiter itself,
right,
and those were used to get into orbit. What's not as noticeable, there were two other smaller engines back there also, and those were the ones that were used for reentry and also for orbital maneuvers once they got up there.
Right. Well, and essentially the reentry that the space shuttle did was sort of a controlled fall.
Oh, right? All of them are. Yes. Yeah. Well, I say all of them. A controlled entry, yes, is well, you basically are going 17,000 miles an hour. You turn backwards, fire your engines, and all of a sudden you're going, you know, several thousand miles an hour less. And then the shuttle used its ability because of its shape and so forth to lose a lot of the energy just with, through the interaction with the atmosphere.
And it would basically glide back in, right?
That is correct. Yep. Like a brick. Yeah, it's the way it was described.
So there weren't a lot of options. You landed right the first time.
That is correct. If you didn't land, thankfully all 100 and some that, you know, came back, we lost two shuttles, one on launch and one on reentry.
We're going to take a short break again. After the break, though, I want to talk about what I intended to talk about now, which was propulsion. We kind of ignored that. We'll get that into it after the break. But before we take a break, I'd like to thank my sponsors, Heron Point, Chester River Pharmacy, Compass Regional Hospice, and Prince Limousine. You're listening to My Generation on 106.9 WCTR. We'll be right back. Welcome back to My Generation on 106.9 WCTR. I'm your host, Larry Vetter. My guest this morning is Warren Case of NASA, or of a contractor for NASA. And Warren, we talked a little bit about your background and what you do today in the first section. And then we were going to talk about propulsion, but I kind of, we guess we got off on a little bit of a tangent talking about speed and orbit. So let's get back to propulsion, because probably one of the most dramatic things that you see is in space travel is that liftoff. Yeah. When they count down 3, 2, 1 and then lift off, and you watch the engines turn on and just the immense amount of power that's as the flames that come out, the smoke that comes from it, and then just watch it as it lifts up a lot of weight. And it looks like it moves so slowly at first.
Right.
Like it just like it's crawling, and you're wondering, how is this thing possibly even moving at that point? And I know we are, those of us who live in this area are very fortunate in that we're not that far away from someplace that sends off rockets, which is Wallops Island.
Sure.
I have yet to watch a blast off from there yet, but I definitely, that's on my to-do list. I definitely have to see some, because I have never actually watched a live rocket go up, and it's something that, since I was a kid, I've always wanted to see. So I'm kind of excited to do that someday.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. Wallops Island's a few hours from here. And, I mean, you can see them from here, from the distance, as a little light going up the sky. I've seen launches at Wallops, and I've seen launches at Kennedy Space Center. And Wallops is not bad, because you can get closer. As a public, you can get closer to the launch pad than you can at Kennedy. And so the fact that the rockets are smaller, which they are, is made up for a little bit the fact that you're closer to it. And it's just as exciting to be there a couple miles away from a Wallops launch as it is to be about the same. I shouldn't say just as, but very similar to the feeling you get when you go to Kennedy Space Center in Florida. So I highly recommend it. Right now, since you mentioned that, I'll mention they were launching missions to the space station from Wallops for several years.
Yes, I've heard that, yes.
Northrop Grumman, which is formerly Orbital Sciences, is the one that's doing that. They are redesigning the spacecraft, the rocket that lifted off from Wallops. So right now there's a hiatus, if you will, until the next one launches in there. I'm not sure when it is, but I'm sure it's at least a year from now. It was on like 6 months centers, but there will be this gap right now before they pick up again at Wallops.
But that's Northrop. They're just doing the work for the space station, resupplying the space station, right?
That's correct. And that's the but from Wallops. Wallops has a lot of small rockets that go up and come right back.
Question, yeah, the smaller ones.
Right, right. But in terms of going into orbit, which takes the big rocket, 17,000 miles an hour and all that, there's just the one called Antares. And they're redesigning that using U.S.-built booster engines instead of the Russian-built ones they were using before. And that will hopefully be ready another year or so. Don't quote me on the date on that. I'm not familiar with the dates, but it's just there is a gap right now.
Okay.
But it will return. And watch the news, and hopefully you'll see one. Yeah, I encourage you to go down to Astig or go down to that area when you do that opportunity to actually see it closer up.
Yeah, no, I've been there, and I've been to the visitor center, and you can see where the launch pad is. Obviously, you can't get close to it, but you can see it. Mm-hmm. So I'm anxious to watch something, almost anything at this point, to take off from there. Especially, I guess, in dusk or early dawn, it'd probably be pretty interesting to see.
I've seen them all. Pure night, I've seen it midnight from this a shuttle in Kennedy, and other times during the daytime, and they're all great.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you that the methodology. There are more than one stage. There's multiple stages, mm-hmm. And I believe that we talked offline. And you said that whether it's manned or unmanned, it's a similar type of a pattern that the mm-hmm. multiple stages go on. Can you break it down and let us know? Let me know. What does the first stage do? What does the second stage do? Are there other stages beyond that? When does the first stage drop off and the second stage take over?
Okay. Can I start actually maybe talk about the fuel itself first briefly? Because
yes.
It goes back really like to the Chinese back centuries ago, millennia ago, with gunpowder and fireworks. I mean, the fireworks you see on 4th of July, it's really very similar to what we're talking about here. You just have to scale it up quite a bit. That's solid rocket fuel. And that has been around for millennia. there were advances in the 20th century by Robert Goddard, and there are a couple other people, but Robert Goddard especially was known for, he was flying these liquid fuel rockets out of Massachusetts until the neighbors thought it's getting a little loud to have in the backyard. So he moved out to New Mexico. And he did a lot to perfect that. And over in, for wartime reasons, in Germany, they were also perfecting that with the V-2 rockets over there. And those are liquid fuel rockets. Liquid fuel rockets have an advantage over solid rockets. Unlike gunpowder, when you light a gunpowder rocket, a solid fuel rocket, it's going. You can't stop it. Once you light it, that's it. Liquid fuel rockets, you have a valve, and you can turn it off if there's a problem. And you can throttle up, throttle it down. So the primary rockets used are mostly liquid fuel nowadays. But a lot of times you'll have, like the shuttle did, you have, might have side boosters that are solid fuel rockets. When you, they're not gonna, you don't need to turn them off. They just get you till they're expended and so forth. So now you ask about staging. Okay. It's very difficult to get a rocket Flash Gordon style to be on the side of a rocket, on top of a rocket, launch it, and it goes all the way to space into orbit by itself. And when you design a rocket, that was known early on, that, as a matter of fact, Goddard was really involved with the whole idea of staging. Think about what's happening. You're trying to accelerate to a certain speed, and a rocket will do that for you. Once you've gotten rid of about, say, half or two-thirds of your fuel, you still got the weight of the metal of that rocket still pulling you back towards the Earth. Wouldn't it be nice if you could drop off, since you got rid of the fuel, why not drop off part of the rocket too? And that's a stage. That's exactly all that is you're discarding the dead weight you no longer need, because that contained the fuel for the first stage. Once that fuel is gone, drop all that dead weight, and then what you're left with is a lighter rocket with a fuel tank, a completely filled fuel tank, and that'll take you up to orbit. And being lighter, that thrust will get you into orbit, and then you can achieve your goals. Some rockets are two-stage. Many of them are two-stage. But you have three-stage rockets. You have, like, the shuttle had the side boosters that would drop off, two of those on the side rocket.
Solid rocket.
Yes.
Those are the orange boosters orange.
Well, they were pretty much, we had an orange tank. Okay. A little side story. The very first shuttle launch, it was all white. And then after that, they said, oh, you know, if we don't paint them with paint, the white paint, it's like 700 pounds of paint weight. Oh. That was just for looks. So we can put 700 pounds. You can put more things on board the shuttle. So they stopped painting them. And that was, the fuel tank was orange. The side rockets were white.
Okay.
And the shuttle itself was white.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. And then I remember hearing you one time talking about that these boosters are very thin.
Yes.
And it was all to keep the weight down.
Yeah. If I remember right, basically, like in the old days, I can't speak for the rockets now, like the SpaceX Falcon 9 or the others, but a lot of the early rockets in the 60s, the thickness of the wall of the rockets, I understood it was one-third the thickness of a Coke can.
Wow.
Imagine that, you know. And there was one, I forget which rocket it was now, that was so thin that it had to be kept pressure. Unless it had fuel inside, it would collapse. And so if you were sitting out on the launch pad before it was fueled, they actually had to have a pressurization system that kept pressure inside the rocket so it would not crumble on its own weight. And if you go out to YouTube and do a little searching, you'll find a video of a rocket. Again, I'm sorry, I forget which it was, that the pressurization system failed, and you just see this thing collapse on itself, just on the pad, no fuel, nothing. It just didn't have the pressure to keep it standing because it was too weak.
Now, is there something to keep the pressure involved as the booster starts, as it launches up there, and it's starting to use fuel at a very rapid pace?
Right.
Does that tank sort of squish in at that point?
Not too much. What's happening is, let's see. I'm trying to think of a way to describe it. Solids, it's perhaps a better example. Solid rockets, they're lit from the inside, they burn from the inside out, inside the cylinder. And when those ignite, they're putting so much pressure, they're pushing outward, which keeps the structure firm no matter what also. So until the very end, it's pushing out real far. Now, once it stops firing, you have no more thrust or no more forces that would try to collapse it anyway. And there's really no air pressure, no gravity trying to collapse it, so it's not a problem. Hmm. And the same thing for with liquids. You have the tanks. They're strong enough. But once again, once you get outside of the Earth's atmosphere and you're not hitting the atmosphere as you're going up, once you're in space, there's not a lot of force working against you. There's nothing to collapse you.
Nothing collapses at that point, yeah. Now, when you say liquid fuel, what is general components of liquid fuel?
Well, the types of fuel, you have two things. You have an oxidizer and you have fuel for most propellants. So like like the Saturn V, one of these stages used refined kerosene, RP-1 it was called, as a fuel. Without air in space, not like a jet engine in an aircraft. In a jet engine, you have a fuel only because it combines with the air as you're flying through the air. And otherwise, it's like a fire. A fire won't work without oxygen. So for a spacecraft, you actually have a separate tank that contains oxygen. Almost always oxygen's the oxidizer. And so this thing will not fire until you combine those two fuels, the fuel and the oxygen together. It goes in the combustion chamber with a spark, it lights, and there it goes. Other fuels is liquid hydrogen. And by the way, these fuels and oxidizers are typically liquefied, because if you just try to fit regular oxygen into a tank and hydrogen into a tank, you just would not have enough to get in space. So you liquefy them to where they're, you know, close to absolute zero for the hydrogen. Oxygen, not so much. It's not as cold. But they're liquefied, and then you're combined and fed, and that's the way it goes out. I'll mention one other type. By the way, and there's reasons you go with one fuel versus another, the efficiency, the space, the volume. For example, hydrogen's very voluminous, so you need a bigger rocket, but it's lighter. That's the whole part of rocket engineering. It's not rocket science so much as rocket engineering. There was one other type of fuel I did want to mention because I mentioned it earlier, hydrazine. It's a monopropellant. It's a type of fuel that you don't need two tanks. It's the type of fuel you don't need to keep cold.
Oh.
It's a monopropellant, so as long as you know, can start it, it will, when you combine two parts, they automatically start. And that's for spacecraft that are going to be operating for years. Like the Voyagers that were launched in 1977, 78, they are still operating, and they still have a fuel that works after 40-some years.
Really?
So and they're out past Pluto and Neptune.
Yeah, they're way out there.
Yeah, and that's hydrazine.
Really?
And very toxic stuff.
And there's still a certain amount of fuel in there.
Yeah, oh yeah.
After all these years.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't use all that much fuel to keep going.
No, it doesn't need fuel to keep going. It's just for attitude, control in the direction it's pointing. And if there was a reason to slightly change its direction, but that those days are past.
Well, yeah, I would imagine so, because by the time you find out that there's a problem where you have to turn it, it must be a couple of days before we get the message. And who knows what would have happened in the meantime.
Yeah, but no, you don't have to. The path it's going is the way that they want it to go. So the only issue then is you have little thrusters on board to orient the spacecraft. And those are separate from the main thruster.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a short break again. You're listening to My Generation on 106.9 WCTR. We'll be right back. Welcome back to My Generation on 106.9 WCTR. I'm your host, Larry Vedder. My guest this morning is Warren Case of NASA, contractor for NASA. And Warren, we talked about a lot of fascinating items so far. We talked about your background a little bit. We talked about speed in space and maintaining orbital speeds. And last section, we talked a lot about propulsion, which is obviously getting us there. So I wanted to start this final section talking a little bit about the upcoming missions that we have. And Artemis, obviously, is the one that's most forefront on everybody's mind. That's because it's in the process of happening right now. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the next set of missions that are going to land people back on the moon again. And I read recently that there was a bit of a setback on that. I know there was supposed to be something going up. I thought it was in 2024. It was a spacecraft that was supposed to, I believe, just orbit the moon and come back, unmanned, orbit the moon and come back.
Manned, and, yeah.
Oh, that was going to be manned.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought we were going to start with an unmanned one first. All right, I read recently where that the whole thing's been backed up about a year. Do you have any idea what happened, why they did that?
I would say it's with any complex development program. I'm not tied to Artemis, so I can't give you the details just because I don't know them.
Right.
I basically read the news as well. They're encountered difficulties, as you know, with any major complex cutting edge project. And right now it's been pushed back, I guess, a year or so till the next flight. They had one flight already. And so the next flight would be to go around the moon and come back, sort of like Apollo 8 did many, many years ago, but basically to recreate that. And then that would be followed by the following flight would be to land on the surface of the moon.
Are they being extra cautious this time? Because it seems like we're repeating a lot of the things that were sort of done before, 50 years ago plus.
Right. Well, you got to put in context, too. Keep in mind, when NASA was in the 60s, it was go to the moon, go to the moon, go to the moon. And NASA had like 4% of the national budget, of the federal government budget. Now it's like one-tenth of that as a percentage. And it also has a big portfolio of other types of missions. A lot of missions to Mars, unmanned missions into Saturn, Europa Clipper going to Jupiter's moon with this subsurface ocean, all that stuff. And then you have Earth observing missions. Anyway, it's split many, many different ways. So the amount dedicated to development of the new rockets is a fraction of what, you know, NASA had in the 60s. And that's understandable because it's a race against the Russians.
Yeah. Now, I've often wondered, is there more of a value of actually putting people on the moon, or are we better off spending money on really upgrading probes and equipment to land there? I often wonder, does that make more sense just to have probes go up and do the research, or is it still better to have people there?
Well, you know, it's a question that's been debated a lot ever since, you know, John Glenn launched, or Alan Shepard went to space. Is the technology's improved so much that you can learn a lot from unmanned missions that goes there, that go to those destinations, whether it's the moon, Mars, or so forth. You lose the flexibility of having a man there to be able to react to things and so forth in a way that a machine certainly at present cannot. But the cost of sending humans in space certainly is more. I don't have a clear-cut answer for you. It's really there are reasons, aspirational reasons for sending, inspirational and aspirational, for sending people into space, but it comes at a cost, and you have a lot of advocates for both. I tend to do the balance in between. I like to find where you can have a lot of unmanned craft going as well as have a manned program. But again, a lot of that is personal feelings about where to spend the money and the time.
Yeah, the logical side of me says that it makes more sense to send unmanned. But then the other part of me says that, no, it's much more of an adventure and much more interesting than when you send people there.
Sure. It's not just science. I mean, mostly when you send the unmanned craft and so forth, primarily science. There are some looking at commercial applications, like people are looking at mining asteroids, things like that. And telescopes, of course, those are better unmanned, things like that. But it varies, the reasons.
Are our current methods, our current rockets, our boosters and rockets that we send up into space, are they right now, are they good enough to get to both Moon and Mars, or are we still trying to improve that quite a bit more?
Well, certainly unmanned, there's no question. We've sent things to every planet in the solar system. For manned missions, the ones we are developing are certainly capable of doing that. There's not a good choice if you were to say, let's launch it tomorrow with what we have. You'd have to launch a bunch of smaller rockets, build it in space, and so forth. Even with the rockets that are being looked at with Artemis and Starship on the commercial side, you're still going to need multiple launches and so forth to do it the way it's being envisioned now. So it's in the process.
Right. And it's my understanding that the moon missions, the Artemis missions, once it's really rocking and rolling and moving along, the plan is a station on the planet, on the moon itself, somewhere around the South Pole, and then there would be a station, also a manned station, orbiting the moon as well.
Yeah, it's the Gateway, it's called. Right. And that would be used, and again, I'm not working in that area.
So right, this I understand.
Yeah. I'm speaking as an interested person, but not working in that area. So I hope I don't make any mistakes when I say anything here. But yes, there would have this station called Gateway, that's in a very elliptical orbit around, and it will be used as a staging place. From that point, actually, a Starship would go from there down to the surface of the moon.
Okay. And then I would imagine probably the long-range plan to head to Mars would probably be better to launch something to Mars from the moon than it would be from Earth.
Well, it's a trade-off. You certainly, the gravity of the moon is so much less. The gravity well, if you will, is so much less at the moon. If you could launch from there, you need much less propulsion to do it. That makes a lot of sense. This is personal opinion now as much as my own experience. If you can produce a lot of the things you need for a mission on the moon, if you're just bringing them from the Earth, building them on the moon, and then launching from there, it's less of a case.
Okay. Now, based on today's technology, if they set off or send a rocket towards the moon today, how long would it take to get there?
Well, the answer is it depends. Typically, like when the Apollo missions went, it was 3 days. And that's a good length of time for humans to get there. And that's probably roughly on the order as a compromise between speed and the time to get there. For unmanned missions, like the one that just had issues and had to come back and burned up in the U.S. in the atmosphere, a commercial payload, not a NASA payload, that was a few weeks' time because they had the luxury. You don't have people on board breathing oxygen, eating food, all that stuff. So you can take a lower energy orbit, therefore you can deliver heavier stuff to the moon. And they took that approach. So that it would take several weeks to get there. That way there was more delivered. But for a manned mission, that's impractical.
Right. So so once Artemis is in full-fledged operating, the plan is roughly about 3 days, you think?
Don't quote me on that. I think so, but...
Yeah. And then now we're talking also, hopefully, follow up in a number of years to Mars. How long would it take now, based on the technology we have today, the rockets we have today, how long would it take if we set off a rocket today to go to Mars?
Sure. Physics dictates that if you want to go in the least, with the least amount of propulsion, least amount of fuel, it takes 8 months from the time you launch until you get to Mars. That's you basically start on one side of the sun, and you go to the other side of the sun, and there's Mars waiting for you when you get there. So only when those things line up every couple of years that you would do this. Obviously, if you have more fuel and you got plenty of fuel and plenty of rocket power, you can make it in 6 months, 4 months, whatever. But the quicker you make it, you're using a lot of fuel.
Mm.
And you flip that around, that means for the same amount of fuel, you're delivering less payload, less people, less vehicles, less housing, whatever, because you used all that extra fuel you could have used and gone slower and gotten there in 8 months.
So based on current technology, a mission to Mars is quite an undertaking.
It is. And the problem is if you take the lowest energy route, 8 months to get there, 8 months to get back. But the problem is the planets aren't lined up right away.
And so you may wind up waiting even longer.
Oh, you would wait, yes. And I should know the answer to this, and it's off the top of my head. But you're looking at a couple years for the round trip. I forget the exact how long time. It's very specific. I just forget what the number is.
Yeah.
Because 8 months to get there, you land, do your stuff, and you're sort of forced to stay there until the planets line up again. And once they do, you'll take 8 months to get back.
All right. Wow, so that's quite an undertaking. So now when they send the probes that are landing on Mars right now, they take about 8 months to get there.
They do. Yep.
They do. They take that. All right, so that's based on today's technology. So
well, that's based on physics.
And physics, okay. Yeah,
because it's a trade-off. If we could use the rocket to get there faster, but then you're going to deliver a much smaller satellite, smaller probe. So you don't want to do that. You maximize what you send by taking time to get there.
Unless we can figure out a better method of propulsion and a quicker rocket, then things would change, but we don't
have... They're all in the right. Nuclear rockets are, under investigation, things like that since
the
60s.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, we don't have a lot of time left, so where do you see the space missions going over the next, say, 50 to 100 years? Do you think that we're actually going to be able to conquer and get to Mars the way we hope? And what's next after Mars?
Right. Well, you asked me to get a crystal ball here and look ahead. There'll be a lot of changes in space. I mean, a lot of the work is going from federal to commercial and so forth. So you're going to have a lot of things. To answer your question, before I get to that, yes, hopefully they'll get to the moon in the next few years. The human race will get to the moon. Hopefully they'll be speaking English not Chinese, but, you know.
But you don't know.
Right, we don't know. So that should happen, hopefully, in the next few years. And it'll be great to see that happen. When you make that next step, there are like SpaceX, for example, they're really pushing. They want to go to Mars and so forth. NASA wants to go to Mars. It's a big problem. It's radiation's a big concern and so forth, not just the time. It takes a lot of rockets and so forth. I have to believe, though, that will be, assuming we're around, then Mars will be visited by humans. Hopefully, and the people that are living now will be the ones that will be walking on Mars. Mm. And that'll be a great thing. There are talks about, it's a lot simpler, by the way, if you do it as a one-way trip. And some organizations have pushed the idea that, you're moving out to Mars and don't expect to come back. And that makes the whole mission profile, how to make it happen, much more achievable. But do people really want to move there and be there the rest of their lives? And and that's a fundamental question.
That's a big question.
Sure. Beyond Mars, it gets a little fuzzy. You know, you're not going to go land on Venus. It's 900 degrees, right. Sulfuric acid atmosphere and all this stuff. Mercury is very close to the sun, although it's also the coldest place in the solar system because the dark side
is constantly dark.
It's very cold. It's not constantly, but it's very cold. But you have, for example, the moons of Jupiter. If you can get outside of the radiation belts of Jupiter, perhaps there. Europa, I mentioned, there's a mission that NASA's launching in October from Kennedy Space Center called the Europa Clipper. And that's go to the moon Europa around Jupiter. The reason Europa is interesting is because from the probes that have gone out there, from the Galileo orbiter and the Voyager before that, we know that it's got a subsurface ocean under the surface, and that may be where life is. So anyway, exciting times ahead.
A lot of good things to look forward to. Warren, thank you so much for being my guest this morning. That was an absolutely fascinating talk. I learned a lot. I wish we had 2 hours to talk because this is a subject that I can chat away for forever.
Sure, Larry. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It was great. Thank you. I'd also like to thank my sponsors, Heron Point, Chester River Pharmacy, Compass Regional Hospice, and Prince Limousine. This is 106.9 WCTR, and if it's Sunday morning, you've been listening to My Generation.